Well, thank you for coming. Those of you who've made it here early enough to get your tents up and pitched and up to the first talk, well done. Thank you. It's good to have you here. For those of you who've not been to Greenbelt before, there's a couple of things I probably should explain before we get started. If you're a speaker at Greenbelt, the only way you can ever get anyone to come to your seminar, well, there's only two ways to get people to come to your seminar. One is that you come up with an outrageous, shocking, blasphemous title. Preferably if you could involve sex, that's good as well. If you can involve blasphemous sex, that guarantees you a big crowd. That's the first way to get a crowd at your seminar. The second way, option two for getting a crowd at your seminar, is be Rob Bell. I'm not Rob Bell, which means by a process of deduction you've worked out that I've tried to come up with a seminar title that might attract a bit of a crowd. But it's not an entirely glib seminar title. I think when we look at Jesus, what he taught and how he acted, there's a pretty strong case to say that at very best he had an ambiguous attitude towards family and children, and at worst seems to have been hostile to the notion. It's interesting, I think, that one of the institutions that's been so strongly supportive of notions of family and outspoken in its defence and support of children, i.e. the church, owes its views to someone who held views, I would say, that seem at least to run strongly counter to that attitude. There is more than a hint of irony in that. If you're sat next to an evangelical, actually, if you could lean over and explain irony to them, that would be really brilliant. So Welcome to Jesus is a homewrecker. My name's Nigel Vandell. I work as the Director of Church Partnerships at the Children's Society. This is the first year Children's Society has been a partner of Greenbelt. So the first thing to say is thank you for letting us come to your festival. If you've not come across Children's Society before, do drop in on our stall in the G-Source, say hello and find out a bit more about what we're doing. So what am I going to be talking about? I want to start out by looking at some Bible passages to see if we can establish what Jesus actually thought about family. And we're going to do that not just by looking at what Jesus said, but also thinking through some of the implications of his actions as well. A lot of New Testament ethics either relies on what Jesus said or what Jesus did, and sometimes they don't bring the two together, and that's a mistake we need to avoid. When we've done that, I want to contrast what Jesus' attitude to family is with some of the research that the Children's Society has been doing over the last year on something called children's subjective well-being. Basically, what children say about their own lives, what makes them happy, what makes them sad, what makes them content, what makes them distressed. And what we're going to do is look very specifically at how Jesus' teachings contrast entirely with what our research tells you should be the best thing to do for family and to nurture family and children. And that gives us a dilemma, especially a dilemma for a Christian organization looking to care for and nurture children, because what we find, as I said, is that the life and example of Jesus isn't very helpful. If you are trying to construct an ethic of family and children, you might not choose to start with Jesus. All being well, I want to find a way out of that dilemma by suggesting one reason why Jesus might have said and did the things that he said and did. And that reason gives us a clue, I think, as to how we might better care for children and family in the world today, and what the role of the church might be in that. So if that sounds really dull, I'll tell you the answer now. Then you can fall asleep for 40 minutes, come back and exit. So the answer, well, it turns out, on careful inspection, and I have to say this came as a huge surprise to me, that what Jesus really wants is for all of you to become lifelong supporters and volunteers for the Children's Society. Who would have guessed? So what we're going to do in the seminar, we're going to do some theology. If you're sat next to a charismatic, you might just want to lean over and explain theology to them. And we're going to be looking at the Bible. And if you're sat next to a liberal, you might just want to lean over and explain Bible to them. Right, let's get going. Let's get started. Is Jesus pro-family? And bearing in mind who I work for, is Jesus pro-children? So let's start with a little bit of the Bible and look at two passages that we might want to consider together. First, this from Mark 13:12. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And this from Luke 12, starting at verse 51. Do you think I have come to bring peace to the earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. From now on, five in one household will be divided, three against two and two against three. They will be divided, father against son and son against father, mother against daughter and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. It's not a strong start for Jesus as being pro-family. But we need to unpick these two passages a little bit more. The Mark passage comes from the so-called Little Apocalypse. And this is clearly an eschatological passage. This is looking forward to the moment in history when the future kingdom of God comes, a dramatic moment that changes history. And the section from Luke comes just after Jesus is talking about the future coming of the Son of Man. So again, we need to look at these in context. The first question is this in fact something Jesus really wants to happen? Or is he just predicting what might be coming at the moment when the kingdom comes? Is this something Jesus requires or something that Jesus is warning about us? When it comes to that passage in Mark as well, we need to ask when it might have been written. Most scholars seem to suggest that it was written at roughly the time of the Jewish war against Rome in the late 60s AD. And if that's so, the passage might be reflecting what's happening at the time. During the war, Jewish families were being pulled apart by conflict and knowing whether they should be loyal to the Jewish revolution or whether to the Royal Empire, Roman Empire. And it's not surprising if Christian families or followers of Jesus at that time would have been pulled in similar ways in this civil war. Are we loyal to Rome or are we loyal to the Jewish uprising? And what might be happening is that families might be being pulled apart by this conflict and loyalties. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that this passage is in the Bible to reassure families who were being torn apart that Jesus had said this was going to happen. And that actually this is a piece of theology that's about pastoral reassurance, that if you keep the faith, all will be well, and not a piece of moral theology saying this is what's the right thing to do. So we may have some get-out clause by saying that this is not really a moral requirement, but a bit of a regrettable necessity. But is that good enough? Well, in spite of this fact that these passages are looking to the future, I don't think we can dismiss them entirely. The fundamental point is that the coming of kingdom of God, surely something we consider a good, is associated with family breakup and family conflict. So while we may not take these passages as a moral endorsement, we just can't pretend that they have no bearing on what we say about the kingdom of God and what the coming of the kingdom requires. So some get-out clauses, but I'm not entirely convinced. But even if we push those passages to one side, there are others that make for some uncomfortable reading too. Luke 9:59. To another, Jesus said, "Follow me." But he said, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Let the dead bury their own dead." Luke 8:19. Then Jesus' mother and brothers came to him, but they could not reach him because of the crowd. And he was told, "Your mother and your brothers are standing outside waiting to see you." But he said to them, "My mother and my brothers are those who hear the word of God and do it." And perhaps most tellingly in Luke 14:26, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, cannot be my disciple." So now we really do have a problem. We see Jesus telling a young man to walk away from one of the most important family obligations he has to uphold. We see him dismissing his own family in a way that seems to regard them as irrelevant. And finally, we have Jesus talking about discipleship as being something that should break up families and engender hatred. Here, if we didn't have a moral imperative before, we seem to have a moral imperative. And even if we accept that some of this is hyperbole, that Jesus is exaggerating, we seem to have to accept that Jesus is being quite critical of family here. And this is a trickier set of passages for people to deal with. And you can tell as soon as you start looking at the commentaries and seeing people squirm to try and get out from under some of the implications of this. So what we see when you start reading the commentaries is the explanation that the young man's father that he's due to bury is actually still alive. So what he's really saying is, well, I'll come and follow you 20 years later when my father's dead. So the passage becomes about putting off the discipleship. We reinterpret as not being pulling apart families. Then we have Jesus being dismissive of his own family, and again you see a flurry of interpreters who are trying to shift the blame from Jesus here, who might seem a little cold, and blame Jesus' family instead. So you start reading commentators that say, well, the real problem is Jesus' family were against him. They've come here to try and talk him out of his ministry and his mission. They've come to get in the way. And so Jesus is entirely right to dismiss them that way. But again, it's not in the text. It's people reading stuff in to try and get away from what are some really difficult passages. And finally, of course, we have that passage about hating family in order to become a disciple. And this, I have to say, is my favourite piece of exegetical acrobatics of the day. Because in one commentary, I managed to find someone explain that the whole point of this passage is it's actually impossible for us to hate our family. And so the real message of the passage is that we really need God's help for us to be able to follow Jesus. And if that's not the most tenuous rereading of a passage I've ever heard, then I am Rob Bell. And as we discussed before, I'm not Rob Bell, that's just a joke. If you sat next to a Baptist, if you could lean over and explain joke to them. So what we have is some passages in the New Testament that suggest that Jesus is at best lukewarm about family. What we also see, and this is important later, is what Jesus specifically seems to be endorsing or talking about is family conflict as a sign that the kingdom of God might be coming. So let's see if we can move to some safer territory. Can we make the case for Jesus being pro-children? Here we've got to be on safer ground, surely, if we look at the passages, as parallel passages across the Gospels, Mark 10:14, Matthew 19:14, and Luke 18:16. This is Jesus' welcome of the little children. All of us have heard sermons on these, and probably some of us here will have preached sermons on these passages as well, saying that they're about the role of children. And when we look again across the kind of plethora of New Testament scholarship and children's issues, what we see is that this passage is used as the bedrock of a lot of Christian teaching about children and what Jesus says about children. And what the scholars tend to do is contrast Jesus' attitudes to children to those of the surrounding culture, Jewish and Roman, that have denigrated children or rejected them as being unworthy and as not fully or properly human. And then what we say is that because Jesus welcomes the little children, this is a contrast, and this is the sign and the moral and ethical basis for the way that we should treat children. We should put them at the center of the ministry, those marginalized and overlooked members of society, and build the kingdom of God around those. But again, is that entirely fair? Well, there's undoubtedly something in it. But I think it's often been overemphasized because Jewish culture at the time, although representing children as disobedient, immature, and ignorant, also talks about children in positive ways as well. It talks them about as being a God's gift. So Jesus' welcome of children is less in stark contrast to the surrounding culture and actually more of a continuation of Jewish theology and Jewish teaching. So we may have kind of over-egged the pudding when we come to Jesus' section on the children. There's a number of scholars as well that have suggested that Jesus' blessing of the little children should either be read as a continuation of the Jewish practice of bringing children to the elders and scribes for blessing and prayer on the Day of Atonement, although we're uncertain if that tradition existed in Jesus' time or was shortly afterwards, or whether or not it in fact is a continuation of Jacob's blessing to his grandsons in Genesis. So if either of those interpretations are correct, then what we end up with a Jesus who is no more or less pro-children than the society in which he's born. So is Jesus pro-children? Well, yes, but not especially so, not dramatically so, not life-changingly so. He seems to actually be within the context of the Jewish tradition at the time. But there's a final piece of evidence I want to throw into the mix as well, which is not to look at what Jesus says, but ask some questions about what Jesus does. Quite often we fall into the mistake of assuming that all of Jesus' moral and ethical teaching can either be discerned from what he says in the parables or the teaching sections, or can be inferred from his encounters with people and the miracles. So either what Jesus says or what Jesus does, and we don't hold those two together. If we want a real picture of what Jesus has to say about family and children, we need to look more holistically and look at both questions. So, does what Jesus did about family and children add anything to our understanding? Well, I think it does, and I think it's not good news either. First, we need to look at the demanding life of Jesus. Jesus lived a life of celibacy and self-imposed poverty. He didn't have a permanent home. He was dependent on the charity of others, and he was offensive to many people in community. As we've already seen, he saw his mission as taking priority over commitments to family and kin, and we've already seen in that passage where he dismissed and rejected his own family. Now, the problem is that Jesus seems to have expected his disciples to do the same. So what does that mean for the wives and the children of the disciples? Now, we have to be a little bit careful here because we don't have any direct evidence of the disciples of Jesus. So it's a tricky game and we're going to go into conjectural territory. But bear with me just for a while. Given what we know about the value of marriage in first century Palestine, social expectations about having children, and some guesswork about the age of the disciples, it is entirely possible that many, if not most, of the disciples were married and that they had children who would may have been up to about 12 years old. What we can also guess is that most of the wives of the disciples had no income of their own, and if they were left alone, would have had to turn back to their parents in order to survive destitution. So while we can sit with the commentators and talk about needing to learn the lessons that following Jesus is far more important than family ties, we need to recognize that Jesus' lived example has a darker side when it comes to the lives of the families and the children of the disciples. So by all means, we're free to admire the faithful commitment of the disciples, but we might want to spare a thought for their wives and kids at some point, who might well be left holding the baby with no source of income, while their husbands rush off to follow an itinerant preacher. So where does that leave us? Well, I think it gives us a real problem, because if we're going to try and suggest that Jesus was pro-family and pro-children, we need to recognize that Jesus is someone who did not marry, had no children, saw his work as something that required the severing of family ties, and asked his followers to subordinate their family needs to his. We have to recognize that in three of the four Gospels, Jesus is ignored as a child. In none of them does he reference his own childhood. He directs his message exclusively to adults and only addresses children by default on one occasion. If you're in the business of children's issues and you're a Christian charity, it's not a good place to start. So does any of this matter? I'm going to just draw breath while I have a drink, if you'll bear with me. I want to draw breath at this stage and come at the question from another angle. Does Jesus' attitude to children and family matter? If he seems to hold that his kingdom values as clashing with family values, does this create a problem for us as we look at family issues? Now, I'm going to come at this from a very children-centered perspective because of who I work for, Children's Society. And I'm going to start from the assumption that looking after children is a good thing and that we need to start with the questions of what it is that makes children's lives better. In the last year, the Children's Society has been looking at something called subjective well-being of children and young people. We're the only organisation in the country doing it. What that means is we've been looking at what children themselves say about what it is that makes them happy and contented, what causes them to be less than happy and fulfilled. And we've been looking at how many of our children are happy and fulfilled and how many aren't. We actually did the survey that we've done across the country among tens of thousands of children with children who came to Greenbelt. Some of your children may have done it online in advance. And if you want to know a lot more about this entire survey and about what Greenbelt children said about what makes them happy, then one of my colleagues, Jim Davis, is holding something called a Good Childhood Conversation on Monday morning, 9:30 in Workshops 1. So if you want to sit down and have a big chat about children's issues and how we take care of those, you might want to look at that in your diary and mark it in. But what I want to do is pick up two specific results that come out of the analysis that we have and compare them with what Jesus says in the Gospels. The first thing that comes out of our research is that the single biggest factor that affects the well-being of children is family conflict. Where families get along well together, then children are happier, which may seem fairly obvious. But interestingly, a lot of the things that you might expect children to say matter don't seem to have as big an impact on their overall well-being. Things like family structure matters, but only about a tenth as much as family conflict. So whether or not you're single, divorced, remarried, doesn't have a huge impact on your children's well-being. What really matters is, does your family get along? Is there love in the family environment? Because if there is, then children do much better. Where there's conflict, children are much less happy. There's an interesting side issue to this as well, because we asked parents what they thought about this in one of our surveys. And what you find is that most parents think that children are quite resilient to family conflict and will bounce back and it doesn't have a big impact on them. Whereas children tell us that it's hugely important. So there's a kind of contrast between what adults sometimes think about what's good for children and what children say really matters to them. Now, whether or not children are happy in their own right is enough of an issue. But actually more important is the fact that we know that family conflict can lead to a whole other series of outcomes as well. Conflict can spill out and have quite dramatic effects on children. Listen to this from Sally. My arm was broken and my ribs fractured. I couldn't tell the doctors that my stepmom did it. When I was 14, I left home. I needed to get away. On my first night, this older man came up to me and said he would look after me. He took me to his house and locked me in a room. I was there for 2 days. It makes me feel bad to think about what he did, so I don't think anymore. That's a pretty extreme case of the impact that family conflict can have on a young woman. But it does happen. Running away from home when you're 14 years old is a drastic step to have to take. And you have to be very brave and probably very desperate to do it. But those are the extremes that family conflict can lead to. Not everyone that runs away from home is a victim of family violence. Quite often there are factors that pull children out of home rather than push them out. The desire to have freedom, the desire to make your own choices. Often children run away and leave distraught and loving parents at home. But family conflict is one of the really big triggers that makes kids run away. And often they end up, like Sally, at serious risk of harm. And why is that an issue? Well, we also know from research the Children's Society's just published that many children run away continuously. They run away, return, run away, return. And if you don't have an effective intervention service at that early stage of children running away, the costs to society mount up. Through police time, returning children, hospital time, children getting addicted to alcohol and drugs, etc. So actually, that chain from family conflict actually has societal impacts as well. And I'm going to stop there and give you another advert, actually, because the Children's Society at the moment is running a Make Runaway Safe campaign. I have it on my T-shirt here. And if you do nothing else this weekend for the Children's Society, can I ask you to join the campaign? There are some postcards on the exit on the way out, and a couple of my colleagues in similar T-shirts will hand them to you if you're interested. And you can write to the Children's Minister, Tim Loughton, and ask him to make sure that there's an action plan in SAFE to make sure that no children should have to go through the kind of thing that Sally endured. So do take away one of those postcards. And if you want to hear more about the politics behind this and whatever, Bob Reitemeyer, my chief executive, is doing a seminar tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. where he'll be talking about the campaign and what we're trying to do. So please, please take a postcard on the way out, sign it and drop it back into the postbox at the Children's Society stall in G-Source. It will make a really big difference. So what have we learned? I've done adverts now. We'll get back to the seminar. What have we learned? We've learned that family conflict is significant and has a negative impact on children and young people. It lowers their sense of well-being or happiness. It can lead to them engaging in risky behaviours such as running away. And those behaviours cost society in terms of cash and investment. So there's the problem. Family, whatever the structure is really important to the care and nurture of children. Yet when we looked at what Jesus said earlier, we discovered that one of the things that Jesus talks about is the weakening of family ties, the breaking up of families in favor of discipleship. Families expected to come second to Jesus' ministry and mission. The breaking in of the kingdom of God causes family conflict. So how do we construct a Christian ethic of family if the very thing that Jesus seems to endorse is the very thing that we know will put children at risk of leading unfulfilled lives? The other factor I wanted to mention is the impact of poverty on children's well-being, and more interestingly, the change in family circumstance. Again, as you might expect, poverty has an impact on children's well-being. Not as significant as you might expect, but you can look at a number of factors and show that they actually impact on well-being. So households where no one is employed are families where children have lower well-being. They're less happy and less content. Families in lower socioeconomic groups are twice as likely to have children who say they are unhappy as those in the most well-off groups. But there's good news here too, in that children's happiness is actually far more decided by the quality of relationships to people than it is by relationships to things. So people matter much more than stuff does to children's happiness. It's that love in the family environment again. But the research tells us that poverty has an impact on children, and children are probably far more aware of it than adults often think they are. When you start asking children about poverty issues, what you discover is that children are often acutely aware and change their behaviour without telling their parents to try and make their parents feel less guilty about it. This is Courtney. Well, I don't like asking mum for money that much, so I try not to. Just don't really ask about it. It's not that I'm scared, it's just that I feel bad for wanting it. I don't know, sounds stupid, but like sometimes I save up my school dinner money and I don't eat at school, and then I can save it up and have more money. Don't tell her that. So we know that poverty has an impact on children's well-being. We know that children are far more aware of family circumstances than their parents sometimes realise. And we also know that children will change their behaviour to try and make things easier for their family. Sometimes they'll keep that fact secret from their parents too. So there's no doubt that poverty is important. What's also interesting is that we looked at changes in family circumstances. And where there's a change in family circumstance, that has a really negative impact on children too. So where household income drops all of a sudden if someone is made redundant, for instance, then children become much less happy. When we think ahead to the future cuts agenda that's going to come in, cuts in social services, people being made redundant, loss in income from benefits, it's going to create real stress and strain in families and have an impact on children's well-being. And again, we get that contrast between Jesus' attitude and what the evidence says. So the teaching and practice of Jesus seems not to take too seriously the economic welfare of families, disciples leaving family and work behind in order to follow Jesus' mission and ministry. It's interesting to note that we don't do that anymore. Ministers have salaries, they have houses, they have pension funds. We seem to have already backed away from that idea of Jesus' model of mission. So maybe we don't take it too seriously. But the fact is that the life that Jesus led and called his disciples to emulate would have caused great financial strain, and that would have a damaging impact on families and children. Again, contrast. So where does that leave us? It seems to me that the message that Jesus both preaches and practices during his ministry challenges the way that we talk about family. I don't think there's much doubt that society in general, political parties and the church take family very seriously. They see it as the bedrock of society. But Jesus' mission seems to be less sympathetic to the notion of family than we are. So we have a problem if we're trying to construct an ethic of family life and the care of children, if we start from Jesus' life and ministry. So let's see if I can find a way out of that dilemma. I'm going to park it for a little while and start coming at it from a different direction. So just bear with me. What I want to talk about briefly is ideas of social capital. Now, it'll come relevant somewhere down the track, but what social capital is about the connections between people. It's not anything more complicated than that. We give it long names so that we sound intelligent. I hope that worked. But it's not really a difficult concept. It's just whether or not people are connected in communities. And we know that social capital is a good thing in communities. There's research from the United States, for instance, that says that in a neighborhood where people know the first name of their neighbors, crime is lower. Okay? People know their neighbors, they know who people are, they recognize strangers, strangers are spotted coming in, and so crime rate is lowered where communities know each other. It's a statistically robust result. There's even some interesting evidence from the Children's Society research that shows that social capital, that connectedness, is really important for children. We asked adults a set of questions about children to gauge their attitudes to children, and then we asked them exactly the same set of questions about children whom they personally knew. On every single aspect, adults scored children they knew as better than the children they didn't know. So knowing children makes you like them more. Just that act of knowing them. Children no longer become the hoodies on the corner. They're Mrs. Jones's kid from number 47 who used to babysit for us and is all right, really, when you get to know him. So the relationships between adults and children become less confrontational, more sympathetic, and you're less likely to get into a problematic situation. So social capital is good for children and families and good for society. And still we have Jesus' attack on families and a reduction of social capital. So surely I'm making Jesus out to be even worse, aren't I? But we need to be a little bit more careful here, because academics tend to divide social capital up into a number of different types, and I'm going to let you know about two. One of them is called bonding social capital, which is the way of describing connections between people within a group, families, close friends. They tend to be people that are very similar backgrounds or often who know each other. And the second kind is bridging social capital, and that's the capital that connects people across communities, neighbours from different groups with different interests and different backgrounds. The kind of bridging capital that crosses class divides, race, ethnicity, age, religion, etc. Now, the point is that both of those social capitals have good and bad sides. If we take that bonding social capital that brings people together, the danger is that as it brings groups of like-minded people together, it excludes others. So what you do is you end up with a tight-knit group of people who share the common background, and they exclude and alienate people that aren't members of that group. Families do it. Not only that, but closely connected groups tend to perpetuate behaviours. So if those behaviours are problematic, then those behaviours get learnt and passed on in the group. We call it peer pressure. but it's bonding social, bonding social capital, keeping up with the Joneses. And if you end up with too much bonding social capital in a community and not enough bridging, then you run the risk of ending up with a fractured and very fractious community. So let's get back to Jesus. Can we make a case that what Jesus is doing in his teaching about family is something to do with social capital? Not that he necessarily thought in those terms, but that he might have, that we might be able to interpret it in that way. Can we make the case that Jesus is not trying to undermine family, but undermine a notion of family that's exclusive and individual and looks in on itself rather than out at the wider community? Is Jesus' teaching not so much an assault on family, but a way of trying to build a bigger family beyond the biological? If we use the jargon, is Jesus trying to redress a balance in society to have a better mix of bridging and bonding social capital, which really wouldn't have been as good a sermon as in any parable he wrote? Well, if we try and make that case historically, it's pretty much impossible. Not that it necessarily flies in the face of the evidence, but we don't really know what family life at peasant level was like in first century Palestine. We don't know if families looked inward and were generally exclusive of others. So there weren't a lot of social scientists around 2,000 years ago giving me the kind of study I want. So there's not a lot we can say about that. But when we look at society today, there is some interesting stuff. What I've already told you is a little bit, I've told you one example of how bridging social capital, building bridges across different groups is good for society. The fact that adults are more sympathetic to children and young people they know shows that those personal connections can have a positive impact. And there's also evidence that that kind of bridging social capital is decreasing. There's a study by Sheffield University in 2008 that estimated over the last 40 years, about 97% of communities in the UK have suffered a decrease, have become more fragmented, less bridging social capital. And as communities have become more fragmented, we see a collapse in trust levels. In 1959, about 56% of people said that most people were trustworthy. In 1999, that was down to 29%. So as society becomes more fractured, we no longer trust our neighbours, and we actually no longer think of them as moral and honest. So the number of people saying their neighbours are moral and honest also declines. May not be true, but the perception is there as communities have fragmented. So what appears to be happening is that people are becoming more individualistic. We're becoming more obsessed with the family, the people I know, and looking after my family at the exclusion of people outside. And that might be having a bad impact because we don't trust our children out in society anymore. So while we can't make a case that Jesus was attacking social attitudes in his own day and time, we might be able to make the case that if we had a bigger view of society, if we could push the boundaries of family to include a wider community, if we could take a more inclusive view of our responsibilities to other people and children, and if that's what Jesus was really getting at, then he had a really good point. So this, I hope, has all been very interesting, but the final question is, what has this got to do with us and the life of faith today? And the point is, if we're going to try and discover or build bridging social capital in local communities, where are we going to find it? Where are we going to find a community that breaks through some of the social barriers and can create a society that corporately cares for people? And it's an obvious answer. Surely has to be something to do with church. One of the things we know about religious communities, again from some surveys, is that they are full of nice people. I say this not to flatter you, but because there's a lot of research data on it. What we know is that by every measure of niceness, religious people, this is survey data mainly from the United States, but some of it exists in the UK too, religious people are nicer than the general public. They're more likely to give money to charities in terms of donations. They're more likely to be generous in terms of their time in volunteering. They're more likely to be engaged in public life through voting. They're more likely to give money to a homeless person. They're more likely to give back excess change to a shopkeeper. They're more likely to donate blood. They're more likely to help someone outside of their own home do housework, spend time with someone who is depressed, or offer a seat to a stranger, or help someone find a job. Every single measure of niceness. Religious people are really nice. If I was going to be provocative, you could ask the question, not about whether or not religion is good for society, but whether you can construct a civilized society without religion, a question I'm sure that Dawkins will ignore. So not only by their nature that churches that give us the ability to reach out across social, racial, and age barriers, not that it always does, but it's something that churches can do. Many of our churches do include people of very similar social backgrounds, but some cross the divide. And at the very least, churches become places where different age groups can meet, young and old, can get together. And we've already seen that when that happens, attitudes between the groups get better because people get to know each other, meet each other, and trust each other. We build, rebuild some of that bridging social capital. So if we want a society where young people, children are valued, then what I'm saying is we need a bigger collective effort, not just family, but a bigger shared responsibility for the children in our midst. And I think the church is a place that might deliver that. So to draw this all to a close, and then you can ask some questions. Where have we got to? We started off by saying that in Jesus' teaching and Jesus' practice, there's an attitude to family and home life that's quite challenging to what research tells us about what children need. We find that the coming of the kingdom of God is supposed to cause family conflict and tension, and we know that that's one of the worst things for home life. But there's at least the possibility that what Jesus is trying to do is shatter our view of family in order to give us a bigger vision of a collective society. And there's good evidence that if that's what Jesus is doing, then it will be good for our children. Because we have evidence that to provide a culture for children and young people today that nurtures them, we need a more collective society, community view. We need to take collective responsibility. What's interesting in all of this is true is that it becomes a challenge to the church. Because of all the institutions in society at the moment, the church seems in an ideal place to do some of that, to make some of that bridging social capital, to bring communities together across boundaries and social divide, not least across the age range. Because we know that when people get to know each other, they find they like them more and they trust them more. So it's a challenge to the way the church might view its ministry if actually one of the things it most does is just bring people together to meet people. So Jesus may have been a bit of a home wrecker, and that may have had a negative, or some of his ideas may have had a negative influence. But what he might be trying to do is undermine the notion of family as the bedrock of success, not to undermine it, but to expand it, to create a wider community that acts as an alternative and bigger home and family. If so, then we've probably discovered a Jesus who seems much more like the Jesus we probably tend to recognize, and a Jesus that challenges the church to be community in a way that's really important in terms of bringing communities together. So that's kind of really where I want to end. What would it mean for the church to act as a model for community that looked after children as community? Is the church able to break down the barriers and build up the social bonding in society by bringing together communities? Can it help people to get to know each other across the divide and challenge prejudices and bigotries? Can it be the place where children and adults are connected across the generations and where children are given a more central place in society where they can flourish and participate? That may not be the way that some churches understand their view of children's ministry. It may be the way some do. But that more holistic vision that not only looks after children's spiritual growth, but looks after the society and community that they grow up and nurture in so that they are happy and prosper. Could that be something that the church does? Jesus may have been a bit of a home wrecker, but I don't think he necessarily left it there. I think he gave us a bigger challenge and a bigger vision. The challenge is to try and make a bigger family, a bigger community, a bigger vision of society, one that is a bigger vision of family, one that is not biological, but theological. And if we can build that, then a little bit of home wrecking on the way might not be such a bad thing. Thank you. I think if you want to ask a question, you have to come and speak it into this microphone.
You're going to have to come over here because we don't have any radio mics in this venue, unfortunately. So does anyone have any questions? If you would like to come, anyone else who's got any questions? You're all waiting to see what happens, aren't you? Just how brave is he going to be?
This is, of course, the bit where I'm really embarrassed by all the questions.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you for that. You didn't skirt any issues and address it, so thank you for that. As you're probably aware, the epistles, the letters in the Testament, were written probably the earliest writings of the New Testament. So from what you were saying is that Jesus was saying, don't focus on your nucleus family, but think of a wider family. Yet within a couple of decades, in Timothy, one of the marks of choosing a leader for the church is how well you're managing your nucleus family. Could you explain, please?
Absolutely. I'll just outline the origins of Christianity for you in there. No, it's a really good question, because what I think you see in the very, very early Christian communities is exactly what you see. You look at the community in Acts, and you see a community that's living together communally, sharing goods in common. And also, if you look at some of the books that never made it into the Bible, if you look at the Didache, which is that very, very early community rule document that a lot of Christians early on spoke a lot about but didn't make it into a Bible. Again, you see a community rule kind of document. And, I mean, I really don't know what happened. John Dominic Crossan's done quite a lot of speculation about what happens to the early nascent Christian communities. And he talks about it going in two kind of directions. One, a more city-based kind of community that ends up in the church we know, that looks more at family, and one, a really radical discipleship thing that he sees as more rural. Now, he does a huge amount of speculating to get at that picture, but I think what happens is the early Christian community is trying to make sense of it and goes off in different tangents, and we have both of those represented in our New Testament, in Acts and in Timothy. But I think we need to look at both of them and not just the one in Timothy.
Okay. Oh, man with the dog. Does anyone else have any questions? Because what we could do is form an orderly queue, which would mean we would stop having, waiting time. Anyone else? Oh, come. I know I'm just going to make you stand out here in front of everybody. I'm sorry about this.
After the recent riots we've had, and the government saying the community, the family, what can a church do to strengthen that side in laws of putting the children first? Because at the moment in family law, children's law, they're not. It is totally Labour government, Conservative, they're saying this, but they don't do it.
Sorry, say again.
The law between family law and children's law in the Acts of Parliament, it's not geared to children. What can we do to, as a church-wide body, to put pressure on there to make the laws more children-friendly and more families stay together?
Yeah, it's actually a very good question. I think that's something the whole of Greenbelt could debate a bit more. I think kind of one of the key things often in a lot of this debate, and one of the things the Children's Society is very keen on, is how do you get the voice of the children into that? Because quite a lot of children law and family law is made by lawyers and politicians, and actually trying to get the voice of children in as the reality of what... I mean, I was mentioning in here that sometimes what adults think and what children think are not the same. So I think always, if you're trying to take a group of people seriously, the first thing you have to do is take them seriously and let their voices be heard in whatever fora. So as we've sat there, interesting enough, as you said, straight after the riots, what we've done, of course, is listen to all the politicians talking about what happened. And at some point in that dialogue, we need to listen to what the people on the streets were, which, of course, a lot of them weren't that young. Quite a lot of them were older. But put that voice back into the debate.
Do you think some sort of the church should get pushed for some sort of judicial inquiry about family and children? It's never been done.
I think I probably need to go. It's going to be a good idea. The question is there a political feasibility? Is there mileage in it at the moment? So I think we'd need to talk to some politicians about the realism of that. But it's an interesting idea.
Hi, thank you. I think I agree with the conclusions that you came to and the points that you're trying to make about what church and we as a society should be doing for children, for families. But I think that what strikes me about Jesus' attitudes in the extracts you've read, I'm not very Bibled, so I don't know a lot of the things that I maybe haven't been said and maybe have been addressed, is that I'm seeing a charismatic young man here who's struggling to build a new religion. And if anybody who knows anything about building a cult, you have to divide people from their existing links and make them part of your your family, and that's the only family and that's the only thing for them. And I think the point that the gentleman earlier made about further down the line, the attitudes had changed and it became, again, about family as the religion matured. I think that maybe fits there. What do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some truth in that, isn't there? There's both kind of in the... how much did Jesus see what he was doing as a crisis point? How much did he think that now was the moment and if we don't act now, then all of history is on the line and therefore you can begin to ignore other things that you would normally think are important. Mm. So there might be that Jesus is in this time frame of now is my ministry on earth. This is the most important thing. Everything must take back seats. But of course, what we've done is we've got that legacy still in our scriptures to deal with. And now we're in a time frame where actually the whole of history isn't hanging on this moment. This is not the moment where Jesus is on his earthly ministry. So again, what we may be having is this kind of moment where we're trying to translate a very different context from one to the other to try and work out what Jesus was saying. But I think what that's done is left us with a legacy of texts about family and children and things that are actually quite unhelpful in a sense.
Yes,
and we need to read them out into a much different context to try and understand them.
You made quite a clear description of why it's reasonable to assume that at least a number of the disciples would be married, that it would be normative within society at that time for men of that age to be married. Yeah. As far as I'm aware, there isn't any clear scriptural statement on the marital status of Jesus himself, but we have asserted that it's normative in first century Palestine to be married. And I feel that surely if his marital status was something other than normative, that would warrant stating. So if at the age of 33 he is still unmarried and without children, surely that would have been worthy of note. And the fact that there's no comment saying anything would lead you to believe that he is in fact married with children, off on his 3-year bachelor adventure, leaving home, family and all his responsibilities, and encouraging others to be absentee fathers, leaving their responsibilities adrift while they go and follow their own desires.
Yeah. There's kind of two... I mean, again, we're arguing in the absence of any evidence, as you said, it doesn't clearly say it. But there seem to be two things, don't there? There's the tradition which says actually that men of that age would be married and whatever. The one exception we seem to have in Jewish culture, though, where it's almost acceptable for people to be both celibate and unmarried if they think they are religious charismatics. And Jesus clearly thought of himself as a religious charismatic. So he may well have been following that trend of Jewish thought and I think he probably was, as a celibate, unmarried, religious leader, and therefore allowed to opt out from the social norms because he was unique.
Final question, thank you for that. I'm just interested in what this says to the church today in terms of what the church can do to impact family life beyond it. So, you know, we see in many communities that, you know, the church has a toddler group, but, you know, the toddler group runs parallel to the kind of church family, and isn't it great? There's the mums over there, and they do the work with the toddlers. And wouldn't it be great if we could actually convert the mums, and then they could bring the children to Sunday school, and they could be part of us and the church? And, you know, what does this say to the church about actually ministering to families outside of its existing structure? Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
practical
yeah.
question.
Yeah. And when we do have this big advantage in that churches have buildings and lots of people meet in them, and quite often what the churches seem to think is, right, we've got lots of these people meeting in our building. If they just cross our threshold enough time, they will mystically convert and then come to church on Sunday and we can meet them. So there's this idea that people might slowly absorb themselves into our church family. Like you said, they run parallel. Perhaps we should think in the other way, and maybe we should be absorbing ourselves into the toddler group. So that in actual fact, those groups that come onto our premises meet us anyway. And we see the church as being a place where meetings take place, where, you know, those people cross divides, where you chat, where people get... So it's not so much hoping that they'll come to us, but making the effort and going to them might be a...
And just final, is the Children's Society going to do something to help to make that happen as a result of the research?
Well, I've done the advert already. Jim, my colleague over there, is doing a Good Childhood Conversation Monday 9:30, workshops 1. And this is a resource actually available to church. If you want to come and talk about what your church could do with children and young people, we can do surveys of your children and young people to find out what they say. We can come into your church. We can facilitate a discussion and a conversation on what you might do and maybe get you moving in the right direction. So if that sounds interesting, 9:30 a.m. Monday morning, workshops 1. Jim's much cleverer than I am, and he's brilliant.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. If we would just like to show your appreciation for Nigel one more time. Thank you.